Listen. It was getting on for 8 when I turned in at the main gates of Deverill Hall. A quick burst up the drive enabled me to punch the front doorbell at about 22. The door opened, revealing some 16 stone of butler. In the circles in which I move, it is pretty generally recognised that I am a resilient sort of bimbo, but I had never before been thrust into the position of having to say I was Gussie Finknottle, and on top of that having to dine in a strange house without dressing. And I don't mind admitting that it was a limp and tottering Bertram Wooster who followed Uncle Charlie to the dining room. As far as the eye could reach, I found myself gazing on a surging sea of aunts. There were tall aunts, short aunts, stout aunts, thin aunts, and an aunt who was carrying on a conversation in a low voice to which nobody seemed to be paying the slightest attention. An aunt in spectacles said she had met the vicar that evening, and the poor old gook was spitting blood because his niece, Miss Purbright, insisted on introducing into the programme what she described as a knockabout cross-talk act by Police Constable Dobbs and Agatha Worplesdon's nephew, Mr. Wooster. What a knockabout cross-talk act was, she had no idea.
"Perhaps you can tell us, Augustus."
"Oh, rather," I said. "It's one of those Pat and Mike things. Two birds come on in green beards, armed with umbrellas, and one bird says to the other bird, 'Who was that lady I saw you coming down the street with?' And the second bird says, 'Faith and begob, that was no lady, that was my wife.'" There was a sharp intake of breath from one and all.
"Very vulgar," said one aunt.
"Terribly vulgar,"
said another.
"Disgustingly vulgar,"
said Dame Daphne Winkworth.
"Well, I am glad," said the aunt in spectacles, "that it is this Mr. Wooster and not you, Augustus, who is disgracing himself by taking part in this degrading horseplay. Imagine how Madeline would feel."
"Madeline would never get over it,"
said a thin aunt.
"Dear Madeline is so spiritual," said Dame Daphne Winkworth.
I did not know what to make of the Bailey's words, but I had little time to pursue the inquiry in my mind. Thomas Stewart eyed me levelly. "Whatever we do will not be lain at your door, Alexander. You have done no more than we asked of you, and that well. Yet I believe we should not proceed further in this matter without first taking further counsel." The minister was wearied of listening to the views of others when his own were so clear to him.
"And to what reprobate must we now turn before we may proceed as any group of godly and honest magistrates?"
The slur on me was let pass as the notary responded in a steady voice, "Robert Gordon of Stralach." The minister snorted derisively, and the bailie rose from his seat in some alarm.
"The risk is too great."
"Stralach is no papist," asserted the notary. The Reverend Guild snorted again.
"No papist? He is a Gordon. They drink in incense with their mother's milk."
The notary repeated himself, an edge to his voice being sharpened by his growing impatience. "Robert Gordon of Stralach is no papist. He is a justice of the peace and one of the best respected men in the kingdom. The king himself does not scruple to seek his counsel."
"Aye," retorted the minister, "and Huntley does not blow his nose without consulting him first."
"Perhaps so. But many's the time it has been the restraining hand, the measured counsel of Stralach, which has held the Marquis back, when his own impetuous nature would have precipitated us all into disaster."
Someone had turned her against him. William Newton, or Maeve, or Rachel, or Robin, or the parents, Anthony the architect, and Tessa with the lofty know-it-all voice. Pretty Susanna, her stepmother, and Magnus the solicitor, her stepfather. They were in league against him. When they were both at Holland Park Comprehensive, he had eventually been invited to her home. At that time her mother must have been about 38. She looked like an older, harder version of Leonora. The same olive skin, the same dark blue eyes, but calculating and watchful. Guy noticed her nails. They were painted silver. They were very long and curving over at the top like claws.
"So this is Guy," she'd said.
He looked about him at the late reproduction Victorian bits and pieces. Guy's home was a dump, scarcely furnished, tea chests and mattresses on the floor. But he knew what was good, and what he would have one day. The weak glow from the gas and the first glimmer of daylight slipping past the old blackouts are enough to let her see her visitor in silhouette.
Is that you, Jean?
There's a giggle which she hasn't heard for many a month.
Yes, Granny. Have you forgot me?
The old woman tuts.
Do you think Granny would forget her wee pal?
She makes the decision to ask straight out.
What have you come for, Hen? I've been sent. 'Cause you know things will be all right if you're with me.
As the child speaks, the gas flame burns brighter, the mantle begins to glow, the room is lighter. She can now see the child's face whenever she turns her head to the right, towards the light. All of a sudden it feels so good to be lying in bed, talking to the bairn. There is no fear. The old woman looks down.
I see you've still got her kaleidoscope, Hen.
Uh-huh.
Nobody else gets to look through it, Granny. I've been waiting for you. Ah, now isn't that nice? But I've been no weel, Jean. I dinna think I've got the strength to get out of bed and get ready to go wee.
Jean laughs.
Don't be silly. It's easy peasy.
The old woman watches her transfer the kaleidoscope to her left hand, then hold out her right.
All you do is take my hand, Granny.
She gives her little girl shrug, and the blonde curls bounce like always.
And that's it. All done.
The Fox Tower still looms over Armour Factory Alley. It looms over the ancient Tartar Wall, where Pamela was found that freezing morning in January 1937. Only very elderly Pekingers call it the Fox Tower now. Only the very old talk of fox spirits. Few, if any, are left who remember the day that the mutilated body of a foreign girl was found at its base.